Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for May 19th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have an interview I conducted with Cory Doctorow, catching up with him on his book tour to promote his latest book, just out from tour. That's For the Win. This is his second young adult novel. It's highly enjoyable. I highly recommend it. I wrote a review of it up on the website when it launched last week. This interview does run long. It's about 50 minutes, so there is no new hacker word of the week, and there is unfortunately not time to get into listener feedback. The only other thing I'll say about the interview, other than that there will be copious links in the show notes, and I encourage you to check those out for anything that you hear us mention that you're interested in, is that in a few spots, despite my best efforts, there was a little bit of clipping on the audio because of a slightly high gain on his end of the conversation. Hopefully you won't even notice it, but if you do, if it sounds a little bit crackly here and there, that's why, and hopefully next time I'll have the better presence of mind to do a sound check rather than being so utterly focused on the conversation itself to try to catch that out. A couple of more things before we get to the interview. First, I'll be at Balticon Memorial Day weekend. I will be speaking on a number of panels, and I will post my speaking schedule up on the website real soon and on the Google Calendar, so if you're already planning on being there, you can look for me there. Unfortunately, it's probably a little too close to the date to get a hotel room if you're not already planning on going, but it's a great convention that you should look into every year. It's just north of Baltimore in Hunt Valley, Maryland. It's a fantastic gathering of science fiction enthusiasts, authors, new media folks like me. Just a great gathering. I highly recommend it. The other thing is just announcements for the next two copy nights, and I appreciate for folks who are running a bit behind, local listeners, that the one for May may get to you, to your listening, a little bit late. But next week, Carl Malamud will be our special guest at Copy Night, hosted at the American Library Association in DuPont Circle. That'll be Tuesday, May 25th, and I'll include a link to the Copy Night DC website in the show notes with all the details. And next month, you'll be able to see the announcement go out, hopefully soonish, about a really big Copy Night event that's being co-sponsored with the New America Foundation and Public Knowledge, and that's to welcome Cory Doctorow to D.C. in late June, June 28th. That's a Monday, so stay tuned for further details on that, either through my website or the Copy Night D.C. website. I'm very excited about that. That's going to be, I think, a fantastic event, and I wanted to get the word out early for anybody who needed the extra time to plan and schedule to be there. Longtime listeners to the show hardly need any introduction to Cory Doctorow and his work. For newer listeners, I highly recommend the past interviews I've conducted with Cory. In them, we've discussed his most recent works as a science fiction author, but also touched on his views as a blogger, essayist, and activist. You, of course, can find out much more about Cory at his website, craphound.com. Welcome back to the show, Cory.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's nice to see you again, Thomas.
So you're currently on tour promoting your latest book, For the Win. The tour winds up a few weeks on June 4th back in your hometown of Toronto. This is your second young adult novel, this time out exploring issues of organized labor, how communication and coordination span the globe, and what it's like to grow up in the developing areas of the world that many of us perhaps don't think about, in particular how they make the life we know in developed nations possible. You traveled, as I understand it, pretty extensively to research this book. Would this book have been written without that firsthand experience, or do you suspect that it would, but it might have been noticeably different?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I traveled extensively. I wish I could have. I had time limits. So what I did was I traveled deeply, but not widely. you know, the idea, for example, that someone could write a book about India as opposed to writing a book about a corner of one city of India, I think is pretty hubristic. I think it would take you a lot longer than I have left in my life to write a book about India and the same, and let alone a book about China. So I went to a few places and spent as much time as I could spare in a very small space and then read a lot. In terms of whether the book would have been the same had I written it without the travel, I fear that it, you know, I think that there's a certain kind of tactility that you get from going to a place that is not, you're not able to recreate with just books. That said, you know, Ian MacDonald has written some amazing books about India and Brazil. There's one called River of Gods and one called Brazil, both of which, as I understand it, he wrote without traveling to those countries. And I don't know how he did it. He's amazing. But I fear that I would end up more like Kafka with his book America, which is this, it's a book that was published after he died. It was his first book, as I understand it. And it was, he read a bunch of books about America and then wrote a novel set in America and just got all these howlingly dumb details wrong. Like, people were rowed ashore from the Statue of Liberty in longboats and then came onto the island of Manhattan, where billionaires were carried through the streets on palanquins by half-naked giants. And, like, he really kind of, it was a very funny kind of version of America, a little like there's an infamous dictionary called English as She Is Spoke that was written, I think, by a Portuguese. It was an English-Portuguese dictionary, and it was... the guy who wrote it didn't speak English. So he was translating another book from, I think, Italian or something, and then translating that into Portuguese and then into English again, using the Italian dictionary. And it came out being completely funny and terrible.
Would that have stopped you, though? I mean, you might have embraced that of writing something a little bit absurdist. Or is that just not something that interests you at this point?
I think I would have tried to finesse it by putting it very far in the future, or putting it in a place that was undergoing great social upheaval and wasn't the same, a place that had an enormous amount of expatriates, a place that had just seen an enormous amount of refugees, something like that, right? I think that's how, as a writer, you kind of... misdirect people's attention, direct people's attention away from the cracks in the wall, is by adding stuff. There's my friend James D. MacDonald, who's a science fiction writer and an ex-military man. I teach writing with him sometimes at the Viable Paradise Workshop in Martha's Vineyard, and he said that the hardest thing for a writer to write is a gun, because gun nuts know guns, and they will send you long, slightly threatening letters about the problems you've made with your guns. And he said, there's a really easy way to solve this. And it's just to insert the word modified in any description of a gun. He pulled out his modified Walther PPK. And at that point, the clip can hold any number of bullets. It can have any kind of grip. It can have anything, right? So just add the word modified and you can finesse anything.
I can totally understand that point as an amateur lock picker. That's a common hobby amongst techies and hackers. That's one of the things I find infuriating is authors who gloss over. It would be easier if they just said simply, "and he picked the lock."
Right, instead,
they try to procedurally describe it and invariably get it wrong. And that's more frustrating than if they just... I don't know that there's an equivalent that you could say, throw in something like modified to change it. But just... not dwelling on it. I don't know what it is that drives some, especially it seems like fantasy authors. So they have some rogue character and they feel compelled to try to, and it's like, a little bit of research, go find the open tool folks, go to your local hacker con. They'll talk your ear off and then you'll be able to write exhaustively and accurately.
Yeah.
You've described this book as a sort of expansion of the short story, the wonderful short story, Andis Game. Was that the main inspiration for the book? What else drove you to flesh out the ideas and themes into a full-length novel?
Yeah, so definitely it started with Andis Game and started with, I think it was on Slashdot originally, there was a report from a games conference of a guy who showed up and said, I'm paying people in Mexico to do repetitive tasks in a video game and selling on the gold that they make. And people were just sort of outraged. And so it was before the term gold farming existed, which is why it doesn't exist anywhere in Andis Game. And then I wrote Andis Game, and I wrote about it as though it hadn't happened yet and was to be invented in the future, as though it were being discovered in the future, which is a nice science fiction trick. I call it predicting the present, because it makes you seem incredibly prescient when down the road more of it happens. People go, oh my God, you predicted that this would happen in the future. So this happened a lot, and I got a lot of email from people going, look at this interesting gold farming stuff. You kind of predicted this. And I hadn't really, but nevertheless, I had this kind of steady stream of interesting gold farming stuff coming over my transom, and that got me really thinking about other wrinkles on the story. And a full-length treatment. Originally, For the Wind was a treatment for a series of graphic novels. And the idea was that it would be in like three-book arcs, a little like Transmetropolitan was, and that each three-book arc would be a different virtual world in a different city. So the kids in Jakarta fighting space pirates, you know, the kids in Caracas as orcs, you know, and kind of a lot of that stuff. And I still think I might do that someday. It would be a really fun series of graphic novels.
I'm pretty happy with the end result. I think as a novel, the interpersonal relationships that happen either in person or through the game worlds is at least as fascinating as the game worlds, and if not in many cases, much more compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Many of your stories have explored aspects of current economic models or speculated about alternate economies, for instance, the use of Woofy and Down and Out, and piracy and the experimentation with capitalizing on piracy to drive tastemaking in Eastern Standard tribes. That exploration seems much more prominent in some of your more recent writing, like the short story Martian Chronicles that you shared on your podcast, mm-hmm. Makers, that we talked about last fall, and now in For the Win. What informs your interest, particularly in bringing that much more to the fore? Is there a common thread through all your works that deals with these elements of economics?
Well, you know, it's not so much economics as a proxy for all social interaction. So I actually dropped out of university when they rejected my thesis proposal at the University of Waterloo for a thesis on how the network would make us more socially deviant instead of more socially normal. So that was at the time that AT&T was running the You Will commercials. And they show they were essentially commercials for ISDN video conferencing, for what we're doing now, really. And it was, if you ever tucked your child in from 3,000 miles away, you will. It was a bunch of people doing stuff that was like normal, but using networks. And, you know, I was looking around at transgressive alt-hierarchy Usenet news groups and hacker BBSs and all of that stuff. And I said, and I thought, you know, people who are like socially normal don't need networks to help them, because all of society is structured around kind of helping them do what they want to do. But people who have interests that are outside the mainstream, whether those interests are positive or negative, those people are really, really need technology in order to connect up with each other. And, you know, John Gilmore years later said something to me. We were talking about the shibboleth that pornographers are early technology adopters. He said, it's not that there's anything inherent about pornography that makes you a technophile. It's that anyone whose communication is suppressed through the mainstream seeks alternative mechanisms for communication. And so I'm really interested in questions about rebalancing of or balancing out of social power, of dignity, of collective action. And I think technology holds out a great deal of promise for all of this stuff. But technology also, its main effect is to upend the status quo. So to whatever extent it's giving power to people who are currently powerless, it will immediately thereafter give power back to people who want to reassert it. So, you know, technology gave me the power as an adolescent to range farther and wider than, you know, even the most rich and powerful grown-ups of the day could have gone, access to tools and ideas and communities through the network. But technology today allows authority figures to assert more control over young people than ever before. I think we'll see another swing again very shortly as cryptography, proxying, and zero-knowledge networks propagate. And then we'll see yet another swing back as the authority and the state try to find a way to reassert themselves. So that's what technology does, I think.
Well, that definitely resonates, I think, with the work around censorship on the net that, like, Jonathan Zittrain and Ethan Zuckerman are doing at the Berkman Center. But I wonder if that doesn't paint the entire picture. Zuckerman had an essay just a few months ago, a wonderful essay, saying that technology really wasn't enough, that anti-circumvention tools weren't enough to affect this change.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what his argument was about that. Well, I think his argument was that anti-circumvention tools, as I recall, it was a little like Rebecca McKinnon's piece about the 50 Cent Army, which was that in China, the thing that enforces social norms isn't merely the restriction of access to subversive material. It's the creation of enormous amounts of essentially astroturf, right? It's the creation of huge amounts of social material that appears to come from your neighbors that talks about how great the government is and what bad people the people who oppose it are. And I think he's right, and I think Rebecca McKinnon's right about this too. So I have two answers to that. The first is what Joe Lewis said when they asked why someone who was working for social change, he was still going to go fight in World War II. And he said, well, there's plenty wrong with the world, but Hitler won't help, right? So whatever's wrong in China, it isn't made better by the absence of access to foreign tools and ideas. I think the presence of those tools and ideas will improve things. Whether they're the best place to go, I don't think that's true. The next thing I would say is, yeah, anti-circumvention tools are a small piece of the large toolkit of technologies that we need to make to help people have more self-determination and freedom all over the world, including in the U.S. and other developed nations. I think anti-circumvention is a good problem to be solving because it's a hard problem, and it's the tool of control that's kind of the choice in many countries right now. But it's not the last tool we should develop or the only tool we should be working on.
Yeah, that certainly echoes his conclusion. He also talks about beyond the arguments that McKinnon makes, he talks about something that speaks to me as a technologist, the technical issues of scaling. These proxies,
yeah, that
the operational costs don't scale up very effectively to the point that, like in Clinton's speech about an open internet, I think that's part of what prodded him to write it. And then also just some of the ambiguities that start to come out of that is that proxies now are kind of at the periphery. If you're technically savvy, you're aware of them, you know how to utilize them. As they may become more into mainstream awareness, you start to increase those questions around, well, couldn't this also be used for any number of non-legitimate uses? And it becomes not necessarily, I mean, there's that financial burden for operators, but then there's also that kind of ethical quandary when supporters go to an operator and say, but aren't you also enabling all of these nefarious uses alongside of these ones that could affect disruptive change for the good?
Well, and it's the pornography problem, right? It's that yeah. People whose communications are suppressed in the mainstream will avail themselves of new technology, of new communications technologies as aggressively as possible. And that means that the four horsemen of the apocalypse will ride on your proxy, right? You'll get child pornographers, the mafia, terrorists, and pirates, because that's also in the classes of suppressed technologies. So yeah, I mean, the Freenet people have been coping with this for a long time. And you know, this was something that came up when we were working on the Creative Archive project at the BBC. What I think ultimately scuttled it, well, at least in part, was this BBC fear that Rupert Murdoch would someday be able to run a newspaper headline that says neo-Nazis use BBC material in Remix. And I said, you know, the only way that you can solve that is by so aggressively pushing BBC material out there that everybody assumes that it's just a commons that you can take from. And that headline would be as uninteresting as Oxford English Dictionary provides raw material for hate speech. There's two problems, I guess. The first one is the problem of I don't want to enable people to do bad things. And I don't think that there is. I think the solution to that is to make your peace with it. And then there's the second problem, which is I don't want other people to arrest me or harass me or shut my project down because I'm enabling bad guys. And I think the only way to do that is to be aggressive about the fact that this is an open medium that you can't stop. I mean, today we have people. We have this curious phenomenon, and actually this isn't new. This is I just reread that old Douglas Adams essay about the internet, where we have this phenomenon where people say a crime was committed using the internet, as though this was of some significance, but nobody says a crime was committed using the interstate highway system, or a crime was committed using a telephone. Once we get to the point where a crime was committed using the internet is as unremarkable as a crime was committed using the interstate highway system, then we'll kind of be in business.
That actually reminds me of, I was listening to one of the Twitch shows This Week in Google or This Week in Law, and someone made a corollary in talking to the recent passage of the Digital Economy Act and trying to make people really kind of understand in a soundbite the problem with the three strikes disconnection, the on accusation, rather with the full judicial oversight, saying, you know, imagine replace internet with telephone. And and that makes it much more preposterous. So it seems like a corollary to what you're saying. You know, we're on the cusp of that perhaps being the case that you could say a crime was committed with the internet, and people go, yeah, so what? I mean,
a crime was committed wearing machine woven clothing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in the security space, you know, one of the areas that I follow, it's certainly unremarkable, and it's more, we're getting to more interesting trends and facts about the crimes, not the medium through which they're committed, but some of the other emergent properties that are more interesting for defenders and people trying to understand how to deal with them effectively. So you wrote some time ago about virtual economies in society, specifically in World of Democracy Craft. I believe you actually mentioned that in our last interview. This is also included in the wonderful collection of essays content. Is this book continuous with your thoughts on the questions you address there, participation in virtual economies, questions of rights in game, whether you consider yourself a citizen or not?
Yeah, I think it really is. And it's about and it's actually about a larger area of dispute, which is that over and over again, you have people saying, I have a right to this because it's part of my life. I'm a stakeholder into it, in it. I've contributed some value to it. And other people saying, well, no, your contribution isn't the kind of contribution that generates a stakehold. So whether that's fans saying, I have the right to continue to go on thinking about and telling stories about the characters that you put in my head. You know, you deliberately figured out how to get me to think of these people as real and care about them. You can't stop me from going on and caring about them as people. Or it's workers saying, you contributed the capital, but we contributed the labor. You can lock us out of the factory, but we can stop you from getting in the factory too, because we all, you know, we argue that our inputs into this give us a stake in the same way that yours do. Or it's players saying, we play this game, we live here, you told us to come and live here, we should have a say in the rules. And in all of those cases, there's a balancing of the legitimacy of those claims, the practicality of those claims, and the way that you, if you believe that the claims are legitimate, the way that you allow them to be realized without destroying the underlying resource, right? So like in games, there's something inherently authoritarian about them, at least in a finite game, a finite rules-based game. So take the simplest form, you know, five people sitting around a table to play Dungeons and Dragons, and you elect one of your number, the DM, and you give her a screen, and she gets to roll dice behind the screen, and she gets to tell you what the dice come up, and she can lie. She's allowed to lie. She's expected to lie if it makes the game better, right? So there's something inherently authoritarian about that. Judges don't get to do this, right? So, you know, there's a point at which the governance mechanism changes depending on the nature of the task that you're trying to do. And so, yeah, the idea of for the win is you have gamers who are saying, in effect, first you have the gamers who are trying to eliminate the gold farmers, who are saying, in effect, we have a legitimate claim to be players and then you don't. Even though the gold farmers are all paying to be there, they're all playing, they all play more than the players do, they're probably better at playing the game than the players are, they probably care about the game more than the players do. And the people that they sell their gold to are, quote, real players, right? The market wouldn't exist if it wasn't for people on the other side who are disputing their right to be there. And on the other hand, exactly the same kind of power dynamic exists between real players and the people who own the game, who are saying, in effect, you think that you have the right to be here, but we are, in fact, the legitimate owners, governors, and power force in this game. You are merely our customer, and we know best. So there's a tasty kind of as above, so below, wheels within wheels character there to a game that makes it really exciting to write about.
Well, and it seems like the recent spate of issues and the consequent attention on Facebook are part of that as well. So even if people can't necessarily relate to game worlds or virtual worlds because they just lack experience, it seems like it's creeping into much more the mainstream consciousness through something that people might not naturally think is part of that, but is definitely a form of online space. It's a social space. I think definitely that latter dynamic, that urge towards some form of totalitarianism by the owners, and that sense of, well, I put this information in here. I cultivated a social graph. What does that entitle me to? Seems to be, as I say, of a piece.
And also, you know, I You promised me you would keep this secret, right? I mean, that's the other piece of the Facebook dynamic is, you know, you lured 300 million of us here by telling us that our information would be kept private if we asked you to, and then you change the rules of the game and you tell us that we opted into anything you might do by opting into the system at all. And I think that a lot of people get very upset about that. Dana Boyd has an essay up today or yesterday, I think, that said called Facebook is a utility, utilities get regulated. And she talks about Zuckerberg's long-time insistence that Facebook is not a service, it's a utility, it's a social utility. And she said, well, you got your wish, right? This is what happens when you become a utility. So that's, I think, that was a really nice little bit of neener, that was also quite clever. I think that Facebook really does illustrate the way that stakeholders feel that they feel a legitimate claim on the governance of the systems they use. And it's not the first time. I mean, you know, like AOL moderators rising up in arms over the way that AOL was being run, you know, is a much earlier example.
So what about open source alternatives where you may not necessarily have that centralized authority, like the announcement recently of opening up the sources to the MMORPG Rhizome, or predating that, the continuing work on OpenSim in the wake of the open sourcing of the Second Life client. And then even more recently, again, touching upon Facebook and that more normative social space, the prospects of Diaspora, which is drawing insane attention, you know, 15 times the original funding goal, and seeming to launch much more in direct response to these issues with Facebook. Do you think that there's a different dynamic in play, or do you think the fact that they're being reactive to these sorts of issues limits them and kind of constrains them into that same set of issues?
No, I think, you know, I like the idea of having free open alternatives to Facebook. Diaspora looks kind of interesting. There's a lot of projects that are further along than Diaspora. And, you know, Diaspora, like, doesn't have any running code. There's lots of projects with lots of running code that seem to be pretty exciting. That doesn't mean Diaspora won't grow up to be something really interesting. At one point, there were a whole bunch of free software browsers that had running code, and all Mozilla had was a lot of funding in a New York Times story, and Mozilla blew past all of them. And by the same token, you know, the only thing that Diaspora has is money in a New York Times story. It doesn't have any running code at all. That doesn't mean that they won't be the next Mozilla. It also doesn't mean they will. Yeah, I think the idea of a free open alternative is pretty exciting. The question is the extent to which Facebook, the lock-in effect of Facebook. I think this is what Facebook gamble really is they're saying, we actually own so much of your relationships and your value, and that you are so enmeshed with us that you can't afford to leave, even though we're gleefully screwing you. And there is a collective action problem, right? How do you, you know, you can only leave if all the people you care about leave with you, and they may not. So it remains to be seen how we solve that. I mean, you know, the internet is, like Kickstarter is a collective action system, you know, for solving collective action problems. You could imagine something like a pledge bank where, you know, I pledge that I will leave Facebook for some other social network if 80% of my my friends on Facebook agree too. And once you've all pledged up, then you go. Although, you know, presumably if they all have the same requirement and your graphs are non-intersecting, basically you have to wait until everyone on Facebook agrees. But once you do, you can pull the cord, right? That's kind of interesting.
Well, it definitely seems like a more actionable solution than, I know we saw this past week, was it Quit Facebook Day at the end of this month? I think they're shooting for a goal of a thousand or a few thousand people to pledge to leaving the service. And when I checked it the other day, they had just over 200. Seems like that idea of adding in a threshold like that, despite, as you say, some of the weird combinatorial math that might pop up trying to get there, might solve some of those issues of trying to get to, well, you know, if Johnny and Susie and Bill and Rebecca say they're all going to leave, well, then I feel a lot more comfortable rather than just one more pledge at the end of the list.
That's
without,
right, yeah.
You know, any kind of sense of what that's going to do to your meshing with everybody else.
Yeah, the last thing you want is to be the only guy who goes to the new social network, you know, sit around twiddling your thumbs. The other thing, of course, that you can do is you can go to the other social network export your stuff into Facebook, because as far as I can tell, Facebook is still pretty good about importing, just not good about exporting. And you can just wait until there's enough people on the new network, and then just stop exporting it to Facebook. There are a lot of strategic ways that you can imagine trying to overcome the collective action problem there.
So moving on, I have a couple of questions from readers and listeners. One, actually, a friend of ours in common, John Taylor Williams, has a couple of related questions. He starts with, given the ongoing disruptions to air travel due to the Icelandic volcano, not to mention an overall degradation of the airline industry and the impending strike announced by United in regards to British Airways, do you foresee businesses adopting virtual platforms for remotely conducting meetings? He follows up with, does corporate culture have the wherewithal to shift from video teleconferencing to Second Life avatar meetups as depicted by IBM development teams in Rachel Dretson and Douglas Rushkoff's Digital Nation documentary? And then he has a nice distillation of that. Do you foresee a time when, for large swaths of the population, quote, going to work, unquote, and playing MMOs becomes indistinguishable?
So I think that there's a lot of stuff in an MMO that is superfluous to conducting a meeting, and there's a lot of stuff in a meeting that is superfluous to an MMO. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some platforms emerge that are customized or optimized for meeting. As to whether corporations have the cultural wherewithal, I guess it kind of depends. I mean, which is a very cop-out kind of answer. Once enough young people are old people, I suspect that task will become a lot easier. But I do have a small suspicion, or I would wager money with good odds that for at least some of those young people, virtual worlds will always be have a signifier of play to them that will make having meetings in virtual worlds less formal, and that there may be circumstances in which formality is what's called for. I do think that strikes and poor aviation quality, rising fuel costs, ash clouds, and the rest of it will increase the rate at which we use teleconferencing, for sure. I mean, just involuntarily it will. But I don't think that in and of itself will be enough.
You seem to suggest something there, that there's maybe a space of business-related activities that maybe involve a more creative element, a creative spark. Is there, so maybe not for the entire unqualified set of businesses, but maybe where a creative collaboration, do you think that might be something, or maybe even predicting the present, where maybe there are examples that where people are already doing that in virtual worlds that are richer than a straight-up teleconference?
Well, I mean, sure, certainly there are kinds of businesses that are like this. So, everybody who works with Joey Ito appears to work in a kind of company where you know, meeting in Second Life or WoW makes a lot of sense and kind of plays really well into their sensibility and makes them better and makes them a better team and so on. But Joey, I think, with his friends and coworkers and colleagues, uses campaigning in virtual worlds, actually running big WoW missions, as team building and coordination exercises. So he's actually, you know, kind of beyond just using a virtual world as a place to have a meeting, he's like killing orcs as a way to become better at doing your job. So that is pretty interesting. And I don't know how many firms there will be that are like Joey's, but I think that there will be more as time goes on. Because there are a lot of people for whom the idea of collaborating using virtual worlds is very natural, and that number is going up as time goes on.
Well, it seems like there's pressure on other fronts, like the work by Jane McGonigal on exploring ways to use play as a form of constructive collaboration. I'm thinking of Superstruct and some of more recent work, although the name of the project escapes me, where it's not necessarily the platform is the emphasis of with her work. It doesn't necessarily take place in a constructed world that's made for gaming, but taking that different modes of engagement other than traditional, you know, here's your paycheck and thank you for your work product, but trying to engage people more creatively with micro motivations and more kind of peering models seems like that might suggest at some point farther out, that's where the convergence might be, is there might be some alignment.
Yeah, I mean, I think using game mechanics to motivate people and motivate yourself is a really exciting, it's a really exciting convergence of game design, neuromarketing, and neuroeconomics or behavioral economics. And it's also very fraught. So I think that, we can kind of divide this into three categories, getting weirder and more fraught as they go. So the first one is using a game mechanic to help you achieve a goal. Right, so like Weight Watchers is basically turned into a game, and so you want to control what you eat. You have a hard time aligning your conscious and your subconscious desires. You know, your behavior doesn't match to what you say you want it to be, and you use a game mechanic to help you improve to make your behavior align with your desires. That's cool, and unambiguously good. The second one is we have a social problem, we want to solve it, and games are a good way of helping people understand it. So the dark side version of this would be you can make people stupid about math by having them play the lottery, right? You tell them you've got to be in it to win it, which is like the most enumerate statement you can make about lotteries. Like your chance of finding the winning lottery ticket and your chance of buying the winning lottery ticket are separated by the thickness of an atom. They are so close together, right? You've got to be, it is far more true to say you don't need to be in it and you won't win it than it is to say you got to be in it to win it. So the inverse of that would be something like the game my wife made that won prizes at South by Southwest this year, or that she commissioned, called Smokescreen, which is a game, an online game, where you are, it simulates stalking people using social networks. And what it's meant to do is very viscerally show you that small, harmless pieces of information can be aggregated to make large, harmful corpuses of information. And that's, I think that's pretty unambiguously good too. We might argue about whether your social goal and my social goal are the same social goal, but it's cool, right? I mean, we do as a society often agree on things that we'd like people to know, or that we'd like people to do, or that we'd like people to stop doing, and using games to help them and us achieve those goals is pretty cool. Then the last one is where it gets Huxleyan, which is we have a social problem. Rather than using a game to solve it, we could use a game to help people feel better about it. So, you know, people are worried that there's no social mobility. I wrote a story once called Power Punctuation, in which there's no social mobility, and everybody plays a game called the Anthill Simulator, in which you learn that there are queens and that there are drones, and the drones can't see everything that's going on, but if they listen to the queen, that the right thing will happen. So you can imagine designing that kind of game, right? Designing a bunch of games that are designed not to solve social problems, but to make them not problematic. And that's pretty scary.
Paul Scherf asks, one can argue that the player-created economy is realized when the community establishes accepted exchange rates that are consistent across server boundaries, enforcing the confidence needed for the term economy to be properly applied. Mm-hmm. Why do companies shy away from using this exchange rate to add value to junk items or to lower the cost of items the companies see as overvalued by creating automated exchange mechanisms designed to realign the weighing of the goods being traded?
Well, some of them do, right? I mean, you know, when I was at GDC a couple of years ago researching the book, the really hot talks were about games, free-to-play games that used real money trades to pay for development and maintenance. And the way the basic mechanic was, you are a kid, you don't have any money, you have a lot of time, you do repetitive tasks, you amass virtual wealth. He's an adult, he has a lot of money, he doesn't have any time, he buys the goods at the market. We take VIG, we take a commission on every transaction. And so we found a way to balance out time rich and cash rich people and kind of use, you know, match make them in order to make money. And so there is a fair bit of that. The problem is that game economies are really inflationary. They're really fragile. And they're also subject to sudden collapses if the fun gets reduced by substantially, right? So the inherent value of game wealth is tied to how much fun the game is to play. And if the game, and one of the things that makes the game not fun to play is inflation. So there's a multiplier effect on inflation that isn't that is far more severe. It's not that it's not present in real economies, but it's far more severe in game economies, vastly more severe in game economies. So I think that, you know, they've got the economic equivalent of, you know, a delicate island ecosystem, And what they're worried is, once they start allowing 100 flights a day to land from every corner of the world, that the foreign flora and fauna will swamp their ecosystem. And at the same time, I think they also, economists quite revel in having these constrained ecosystems, because I think, like a lot of soft scientists, economists feel like they're not as they're inferior because they don't have numbers that they can measure. They don't have the same kind of numbers that hard scientists do that they can measure. So I think a lot of economists, this is one of the reasons that everybody wants to be a quant. And I think that it's just like sociologists love Facebook because they can count social relations. Geertz and anthropology and like asking people what they do. Let's just count stuff, right? Now we're mathematicians, right? We're like physicists of human behavior. And I think that economists love that, the economists who run these games love the fact that they get to act like physicists. You know, if there's something in the experiment that is that's confounding the result you want, or maybe like engineers, if there's a cog in the machine that's confounding producing the outcome you want, you can remove the cog. Whereas if you're an economist in the real world and there's a sector of the economy that misbehaves, you can't just by fiat declare it to stop existing.
Well, it seems though that that's a kind of an ironic fallacy inherent in that, though. I mean, you touched on the impact fun can have on a game, causing collapses when the fun drains out of the game. So, up to a point, sure, it's like a captive model that they can tweak in the way you describe, but it would still seem like, especially in the more game-oriented spaces, like there are things that are just as soft and just hard to quantify that could erode that the high they get off of thinking that they're, empiricists being able to observe this and draw trend lines and tweak variables.
Of course, you can always justify anything that you do to the game in the name of making it more fun too. And it's very hard to experimentally verify whether you made it less fun or more fun in doing something.
Some of the ideas in For the Win should seem on cursory inspection to be too big to kind of fit into specifically a young adult novel, but those issues of fairness, cooperation, and competition really parallel the core game dynamic of MMORPGs at the heart of the story, making them easier to explore than if the story or setting were different. Was that intentional when you set out, or did it sort of naturally arise on its own from where you started with the story?
No, I really think that, games and economies are very closely related. I mean, games are, the economy is a big infinite game, right? We agree on tokens and rules and referees and mechanisms for reforming those rules. We sometimes implicitly and sometimes explicitly add game-like mechanics to incentivize behaviors. And all that stuff is very game-like, really. I think Patrick Nielsen Hayden, my editor at Tor, when I was working on my first book, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, said something to me that I always remembered, which is that science fiction is a big story and a little story. It's the world and the person. And the person is like a very high torque small gear that's turning a very low torque big gear. And so everything that happens in the world needs to be in microcosm in the person, and everything that's in the person needs to be in macrocosm in the world. And so that's where, otherwise, the teeth don't mesh. And that's what I tried to do with my novels. And that's, so that's why you see parallels between what the individuals are doing in the game and what the big economy is doing in society.
You've now written 3 young adult novels and a few short stories. When we chatted about Little Brother when it first came out, you mentioned the nature of a young adult story differs. It's more of a dialectic. Are there other aspects you've discovered now that you have a few more under your belt that differ?
I've only written 2, actually. I've got a third underway. Pirate Cinema is underway, but I haven't written it. I've only written 2 young adult novels. Little Brother and For the Win.
A typo of my notes or a Freudian slip.
That's okay.
Your next one. But the point remains when we first talk about Little Brother, you had 1 data point. Now you have a few more data points. So are there other aspects that you've discovered that differ in interesting ways from adult fiction, non-youth oriented fiction, either in the focus of the stories or even in the experience of how you set about writing them?
Well, I think the biggest difference is actually the way that the audiences relate to them. Well, for one thing, I get a lot more email from kids saying, this has really changed the way I thought. This has inspired me to go and do something different. I want to go and learn about security. I want to go and learn about hacking. I want to go and learn about economics. So I think that it's more apt to inspire a course of study or a course of action than in adults. I think adults have a much more self-contained experience with fiction. It's also, I think, more social. I often hear more from kids, "I read this book and talked about it with my friends and we decided X," than, "I read this book and it moved me in the following ways." And then finally, kids are a lot more blunt about how they feel about books, I think, obviously, and predictably. And, you know, my friend Steve Bruce once said that telling someone you don't like their book is like telling them they have an ugly kid, which I really agree with this. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be able to say, "Man, that book stinks." It means that walking up to a writer and saying, "Your book stinks," is completely pointless, because it's the writer wrote the best book she could, and, you know, there's nothing she can do about it now that it's in print. So there's all that serves the sole purpose of informing the writer that you don't like them very much, and you think that the things that they work on are poor. In the same way that once you've had the kid, the fact that the kid is ugly is not something you can change. You made as pretty a kid as you could, and there's not much you can do about it. Now, that I make an exception for young people, because I think that when they say, "You wrote a book I didn't like," they're saying, "I would like to sit down with you and talk about the ideas in your book and the way that it was constructed and learn more." And when I can, I try to do that when I'm in doing signings or when I'm getting email from them.
So you think that that's a consequence of that dialectic, that they're engaging with it more critically because it's framed more critically, and that's more the point of that category of work?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. I noticed that Little Brother and For the Wind seem to focus on fewer ideas, but more deeply, where makers and someone comes to town, someone leaves town included, more ideas, but less answers, you know, begging more questions.
Yeah, more ambiguity.
I referred to that sort of info magpieism around that, and that doesn't seem to be as much a character of these young adult books. In terms of, so is that something you see as well? I mean, is that a fair characterization of kind of some of the differences that an adult may engage critically, not with kind of a model laid out with some rudimentary explanation, but they can maybe require less to go off and do more exploring on their own?
Yeah, or that, you know, adults have enough other art and literature under their belts that the ambiguity actually is kind of a puzzle piece that fits in with a lot of other things, as opposed to young people for whom more conclusive elements are better. I mean, I think both Little Brother and For the Wind have a lot of ambivalence about the things that they lionize, right? Like, so that Little Brother, you know, is not just about how a protest movement always achieves its aims. It's about the ambivalence of a protest and where it fails and its limitations. And For the Wind doesn't end with an unambiguous victory for its protagonist, but rather with a kind of fraught situation where things are different and they're poised to do more, but they haven't actually attained their goals. They're on a journey, not at a destination. So I think that in terms of ambiguity, young people are happy to have it there. They like to draw their own conclusions, but it's kind of maybe a different level of ambiguity.
So that being the case, what is there a conscious thought process about a story matching up with either that young adult audience and the way they engage versus the other option? Or is it more unconscious that you start writing a story? I mean, when we talked back in November, you were already saying I don't think you had done any kind of heavy lifting beyond some of the conceptual framework of pirate cinema, but it was clear that you'd already made a decision there for young adult. Is there there's some reason driving you more into this space? I mean, it's engaging for adult readers too, don't get me wrong. I don't want to turn any listeners off who think, well, this is not, I mean, hopefully they're getting a sense that there's a lot of meaty, interesting things in here as well, that it should be, you know, I view it as something that I can actually share with my kids. It's more family fiction. And, you know, we can have as a family those discussions that you're talking about, you know, kids having with their peers as well.
Well, I guess, you know, partly because I'm writing young adult fiction, I'm hanging out with kids more, and I want to write material that, so I think the thing, you're right, a young adult novel is not a novel that can only be enjoyed by young adults. It's a novel that's intended to be enjoyed by people, including young adults. So, you know, the some of my favorite fiction is written as young adult fiction, whether it's The Hobbit or Daniel Pinkwater or Kathy Kosha's novels or Scott Westerfeld's novels. They're not inappropriate for adults. They're just additionally appropriate for young adults. And so I like to produce material that's appropriate for them. Also, there are some things that are inappropriate for young adults, like sexuality, like heavy sexuality and stuff that appears in Makers that I like to write too. And so I think I'll always write material for adults. But, and in fact, the book I'm going to write after Pirate Cinema, Charlie Strauss and I have signed on to write a third novella together, and it's going to be published between one set of covers called Rapture of the Nerds. And it's very decidedly for adults. It's got, you know, catamites with studded cod pieces and all kinds of crazy stuff.
Oh, can't wait to see that. I love Charlie's writing, and I've loved your previous collaborations. So that's an exciting bit of news. Speaking about kind of ongoing projects in the near future, last time we spoke, you mentioned With a Little Help and Pirate Cinema that we've been talking about a little bit here. Mm-hmm. Do you have an update, more details on Pirate Cinema, something that you'd like to share on With a Little Help?
I've sold Pirate Cinema. We haven't done the contracts, but we've done the deal. And it's, I can tell you how many words it is. I think it's about 22,000 words out of 105,000, I think, is where I'm going to go with it. So it's about 5%, or about 20% done, about a fifth of the way through. I'll tell you exactly. It's 23,118 words as we speak. With a little help, I now have my proofs back, and they're great. And so as soon as I get back to London, I can start doing the hardcovers. And I think it's probably going to come out in August, in September, the problem being that I'm going to be away for all of August. So if I launched it in July, I'd have a month where orders for the hardcover would be coming in, and I wouldn't be able to fill them. So this is my new Publishers Weekly column is about this. When I first contemplated With a Little Help, I noticed that almost none of the tasks had dependencies, which is, you know, a task that has a lot of people who you're going to enlist to help you is great, right? That's exactly what you want, a task with few dependencies. And there were only two tasks that had dependencies, and they were both the tasks that were most labor intensive. One was the reading, and the other one was the typesetting. And I should have predicted in hindsight that the things that were most labor intensive were the ones that were most likely to slip. And everything depended on those two things, the production of the audio and the production of the print, entirely dependent on the production of the reading and the production of the typesetting. And, you know, I don't blame my readers or my typesetter for slipping. I gave them incredibly time-consuming tasks, which then consume more time than they estimated. And so in hindsight, I wish I'd understood that better. The problem being that, of course, now I myself have got a bunch of dependencies where I've got, you know, a month of book tour now and a month off in August and then 2 weeks off in September for a German book tour. You know, I want to now that the deadline slipped, it slipped into my busy time, which means that I'm going to be sort of buggered up a bit.
In that vein, what we talked about last time, sort of the San Francisco or Berkeley mm-hmm. style of experimenting with this, if you were to set out to do it again, do you have any thoughts that have kind of crystallized out of those two things that you talked about, with the dependencies and the slippage, about how you might manage those differently next time out? Or are you not that far along in your thought process?
Yeah, well, no, I think that what I would do in the next one is start the typesetting earlier. So one of the things I did with the typesetting was waited until I had a complete manuscript in hand, which was to say until I had the story for Shuttleworth done. And I could have given him the whole book minus the Shuttleworth story, because it's also the heavy lifting of the typesetting is making the decisions about the typesetting and then implementing them. And then there's the adding another chapter to the end is completely doable. So that was a mistake. I would have started that a lot earlier.
What about the audio? I mean, it seems like that's something that you could potentially carve out as you finish a piece that might go into a collection. Do the reading on your podcast as you go, or as you're working on the draft as you've done, which is a wonderful bit of transparency and insight into your process and your works. But maybe when you get closer to that finished draft, just produce a higher quality version for independent release, as well as then having it later on to collect that up.
Yeah,
is
maybe.
That something you thought about?
I guess having, I think, maybe. The audio was late, but it was so much less late than the typesetting that in the end it didn't make a difference. I think that if I solved the typesetting problem, the next thing that would bite me in the ass would be the audio. But the audio, although it was quite late, was not nearly as so late as the typesetting.
For the Win is in print now in hardcover and available in bookstores everywhere. You can also find out more about the book at craphound.com/FTW. I think that's all the time that we have. Sure. You've already talked about your next workout past Pirate Cinema. Looking forward to that. Once again, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. It was always really nice to talk to you, Thomas, and I'm really glad to be on the show. Thank you very much for having me again.
You're more than welcome. Anytime you want to come back, any topic you want to talk about, I'm happy to have you.
That's great. Okay, we'll talk to you later.
That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend. Or you can go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for the many ways where you can help with the production of this show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, you can call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday as usual, will be a news program, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. Like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is made from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you can do what you like with the content as long as you tell folks where you got it and you share your changes under the same terms.